Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's e-learning with E2R. This is our last e-learning before the summer vacation. We're going to let you all out for summer. Aaron has put a wonderful presentation up together today on the duty to accommodate in the workplace. Just before we get started, as always, there are a few reminders. The first one is, if you have any questions during the presentation, feel free to use the chat box at the bottom right-hand side of your screen to type them out. Unfortunately, given today's topic and the breadth of our discussion, we likely will not get a chance to answer those questions during the presentation, but rest assured, we will answer those either by email or we will schedule a call with an advisor to answer your questions following the presentation. Also, in case you missed any of our past webinars, you can find the recordings over on e2rsolutions.com. And the PowerPoint presentation can be found on your member portal. And lastly, we take this opportunity to remind all of you that the information contained within our webinars is an overview only, and it's not intended to be an analysis of all areas of employment and labor law, and accordingly should not be relied upon as legal advice for any given situation. As always, contact us for any specific questions related to the information contained in this webinar, or any other topic for that matter, and for specific applicability of this topic area to your workplace. So sit back, enjoy the presentation. We'll pick back up in September following this, and let's jump in. So today's topic is a duty to accommodate in the workplace, and just an agenda as an overview to see where we are going throughout this hour. The first is the duty to accommodate. We're just gonna briefly outline some of the principles associated therewith on a general basis. Then we're going to highlight some of the prohibited grounds of discrimination. We're going to talk about all of the parties involved in the duty to accommodate and what their roles are. This is important in order to facilitate the duty to accommodate. We're going to talk about, very important, the consequences of the failure to accommodate. There are some expensive consequences associated with that. And then we're going to walk you through all of the steps in the duty to accommodate, and we have boiled them down to 5 steps. We will go through each 5 steps to talk about what needs to be done at each stage to make sure you are on side with things, and then we are going to wrap things up. So I'll pass it over to Erin, and she'll start on the duty to accommodate.
All right, thanks, Alex. So our basic starting point is, well, where does this idea come from? And essentially, it comes from human rights legislation across Canada. And essentially all provinces have human rights legislation that provides for equal treatment without discrimination on specific enumerated legislative protective grounds in the following areas. Obviously, the ones that we're particularly concerned about is in employment, because as an employer, there is a positive duty on you to accommodate employees' needs relating to those enumerated grounds up to the point of undue hardship. This positive duty is known as the duty to accommodate. So this duty essentially requires employers to identify and change rules, practices, expectations, or procedures that may have an impact on those enumerated grounds. The specific thing is that it's not about employee preferences. We really want to hammer that home. We are not talking here about the fact that I want to go to my kid's soccer game that happens to happen at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That's not what we're talking about. It is very much specifically focused on those grounds outlined in the specific human rights legislation. And it's important to note that it's really going to be that defines how we proceed in this process. The other key thing that unfortunately employers hate is that there's no precise formula for ensuring that we meet the duty to accommodate. It has to be determined on a case-by-case basis. Unfortunately, there is no way for us to say, here's the one formula to apply, and if you apply this formula, you will have met your duty. You will see as we go through the cases today that we discussed that each situation has to be very specifically analyzed for your particular workplace. And even after you feel like you have made canvas every single possible avenue for a particular employee, they may still bring a claim. So we're trying to help you today to understand your duty, how to best document it to help avoid those claims or, you know, hopefully not provide a defense in the event you have one. But the whole idea when we are speaking with clients about the duty to accommodate is we basically want to find a reasonable accommodation that balances the rights of the person seeking the accommodation and the right of the employer to run a productive operation. And the key thing that we always stress to our clients is that you have to be creative. Again, the idea being that it's not a formula that you can apply. It has to be based on a case-by-case basis. And tribunals really want to be seeing that you're making genuine efforts to really canvas any possible way to meet your duty. So that includes various forms of assistance, such as modified workstations, modified hours, special training or tools, or modified workspaces, maybe even time away for work to meet that duty. But again, we'll all be based on the specific request of the employee.
And before the duty to accommodate arises, there needs to be a protected ground in play here. And so we've outlined kind of below a number of the common grounds of discrimination that are common in all jurisdictions. Each jurisdiction has their own list, and there are some unique protected grounds in various jurisdictions. But below, we've listed some of the common ones. So the first one is age. Now, the duty to accommodate regarding age, it's unlikely to arise unless it sort of relates to age-associated disabilities. So keep that in mind. Obviously, the next one is the disabilities. That includes dependency on alcohol or drugs. And so the primary focus of our presentation will be on disability because that's where, more often than not, the duty to accommodate will come into play. Another area where the duty to accommodate comes into play is marital and family status. We'll briefly touch on that today, but we've done other e-learnings in the past on that topic. Race or color typically does not involve the duty to accommodate, but religion does, specifically on request for time off to attend religious ceremonies or holidays. Sex, which includes pregnancy and childbirth, also involves the duty to accommodate, primarily related to granting of leaves of absences, and that there is an interplay sometimes with a disability that may either precede or follow a pregnancy or childbirth. Sexual orientation does not typically involve the duty to accommodate, save and except for gender and gender identity. That's a newer prohibited ground in a lot of jurisdictions. There are some accommodation obligations that may arise out of that protected ground. And the last protected ground that we listed here is ancestry and place of origin. And again, you're not likely to find that much of a duty to accommodate as it relates to that ground. So, as I noted, let's talk about some numbers because ultimately, more often than not, when you hear the duty to accommodate, it's going to relate to disability matters. And we've got some stats here from Alberta and Ontario. And so we looked at between the periods of April 1st, 2016 and March 31st of 2017. And as you can see, disability related claims, both physical and mental disability combined, equal 49%. So 49% of all claims brought in Alberta between that period related to some form of disability. And I can assure you a large portion of those probably involved the duty to accommodate or the failure on the employer to accommodate. And then we have gender followed at 18% and race or color at 8%. Looking at Ontario, the number is slightly higher than Alberta. 55% of cases involved disability. Race was second at 20% and then color at 16%. And then sex, pregnancy, and sexual harassment at 20%. A note for those that are doing the math, you'll see that Ontario's statistics exceed 100%. That's because most claimants will list multiple grounds of discrimination, essentially throwing things against the wall to see what sticks.
So when we're talking about the duty to accommodate, well, who does this responsibility fall on? Essentially, the courts have said that it's the employer, the employee, and the union, if you are a unionized workplace, they all have a role in the duty. Well, obviously, unfortunately, the employer does have the ultimate responsibility because the employer has the ultimate control over the workplace. So the largest component and responsibility does fall on you as the employer to accommodate up to the part of undue hardship, which we'll certainly be going through with you in this presentation. But there is, in fact, an obligation on the employee to participate themselves in the process. First, they should be indicating their need for accommodation, and then they should be cooperating with the employer to facilitate the accommodation process, including providing information that will assist in what accommodation is required, and if possible, also participating in the identification of appropriate accommodations, keeping in mind, once again, it's not about employee preferences. No, are employees entitled to what we call a perfect accommodation. Sometimes we get clients who contact us and say, I have an employee who's advised me that they have a back issue and therefore require a sit-stand desk. They provided me with an option for a sit-stand desk that costs $5,000. Do I have to provide it to them? And the answer to that is no, they're not, it's not right off the bat at least, in that they're not entitled to a perfect accommodation. So you as an employer can request the employee to go get medical documentation from their treating physician with regards to their request. And in that medical documentation, we would certainly say that you are entitled to ask the doctor if there's any other alternative accommodation that you can provide other than the $5,000 sit-stand desk. So the employee then, in that case, would be required to then go and get that information that you've requested. And then in the event that the treating physician comes back and makes alternative suggestions to the $5,000 sit-stand desk, the employee is required to accept that reasonable accommodation, even if it's ideally not what they wanted. So maybe in that case, the possible resolution is instead of $1,000 sit-stand desk, or maybe it's instead more frequent breaks. Obviously, then in that case, that analysis would be dependent upon what the doctor says, but certainly if it's not what they exactly wanted, they would be required to accept it. And then in the event that you are a unionized workplace, where the union really comes into play is obviously with regards to the negotiation of the collective agreement and ensuring that no provisions in the collective agreement have a discriminatory impact on employees. And in the event that there are any provisions in a collective agreement that do create that, then to work with the employer to revise or eliminate them. And then to also cooperate with the efforts of the employer to accommodate. Typically, and we'll go into this a little bit more, where we see that most frequently is with regards to seniority and then working with the union in terms of accommodating an employee who maybe is less senior in a position which typically would go to a more senior employee. And in that case, getting the union on side with the employer's plan to accommodate to ensure that you don't receive a grievance. So the union should be involved. Should be kept apprised, because that's really the best way to avoid a potential grievance.
To understand the consequences associated with the failure to accommodate, we need to step back a second and kind of give an overview of what a human rights complaint looks like. Because oftentimes, when an employee feels as though their employer has failed to accommodate them, they're very likely to bring a claim to the applicable human rights tribunal or commission. Now, there are jurisdictions where an employee can bring a claim to the court to argue a failure to accommodate, especially when it's kind of weaved in with a wrongful dismissal claim. But right now we're just focusing on the commissions and the tribunals. And so in Canada, at both the federal and provincial levels, there are human rights commissions and there are human rights tribunals, except for Saskatchewan, where the court of the Queen's Bench will adjudicate any human rights complaints. Now, more often than not, the commissions will generally hear human rights complaints, investigate them, and decide whether or not to refer the disputes to the tribunals for ultimate adjudication. Ontario, British Columbia, and Nunavut, as you see there, have direct access models, meaning those claims go straight to the tribunals, and our commissions don't serve a function in terms of adjudicating or essentially weeding out the non-meritorious claims. So when Ontario got rid of their Ontario Human Rights Commission, at least that function of the commission, it was seen as a negative because there's no gatekeeper now to ultimately read through the frivolous complaint. And so now in those jurisdictions, applicants have the right to a hearing absent an early settlement. And so that means extra costs for you. And so that's a very large change and a big negative in those jurisdictions. Now, let's assume that we get to a tribunal or a commission and we have been found to have failed to accommodate. There are a number of remedies that those administrative bodies can award. The first is obviously compensation, lost wages, benefits, and expenses. There can be a general order to cease the conduct in question. There can be an order to refrain from committing similar violations in the future. There's that thing known as damages to injury, to dignity, feelings, and self-respect. So we call that usually general damages when we're talking to you. That's what that is. There can be also an order to implement human rights training in the workplace. And so that's something that would obviously have a cost associated with it, or implementing human rights policies. And unfortunately, these administrative bodies have a wide-ranging power to actually order any remedy that they deem necessary to right the wrong and to prevent it from going forward. So that's, it's very vast in terms of what they can award if you fail to accommodate an employee, particularly in the non-union context. In the union context, our next slide, it's a slightly different model, a little bit more employer-friendly in the sense that there are built-in dispute mechanisms in most collective agreements, and it is a faster and generally easier process from the complainant's perspective, but can also be more cost-effective from the employer's perspective as well. And so, unfortunately, unionized employees, unlike non-unionized employees, are more prone to commence human rights complaints and more prone to commence grievances for a variety of other reasons. It's just the nature of the unionized workplace. And there is sufficient proof to establish that arbitrators do have the same power to award the same remedies that we discussed on the last slide as the commissions and the tribunals. So we're not going to be able to get away scot-free or kind of get away with a lesser penalty per se in the unionized context than the non-unionized context, but it is a more direct, maybe cost-effective model in that unionized context.
Okay, so now that we've sufficiently you into understanding that there are severe consequences for the failure to duty to accommodate, what do you do now? What do you do now in order to ensure that you are meeting your obligations to accommodate in the workplace? Well, the first step is recognizing the need for accommodation. So when an employee makes a request for accommodation, the employer's first step is to determine whether or not that request falls underneath one of those legislatively protected grounds that Alex went over. And if it does, well, then the accommodation process is engaged, and we have to continue along with the other steps that we are now going to go through in the presentation. If it doesn't, then there's no obligation to undertake the accommodation process, and you as an employer can just say yay or nay, and that's it. Pretty simple. So a couple of common situations that could trigger the accommodation is, for example, an employee advises that she's having trouble getting to work at her scheduled start time because of new family responsibilities. Or an employee advises that he would like a new office chair because the present one aggravates his back. That information in and of itself, you may sit there and say, well, the employee didn't actually say that they wanted an accommodation. I don't know if that does in fact relate to that prohibited ground. Well, the key thing being is to ask and seek for further information, because as the next slide demonstrates, is that there may be instances where the employee doesn't approach the employer directly for accommodation, but the employer has reason to suspect an accommodation is needed. So in those two examples, that's really an area where you should seek further information to what really is behind the request to help determine whether or not it relates to one of those prohibited grounds and to help determine if the duty to accommodate is in fact triggered. So some further examples of signs that may require further investigation to assess whether accommodation needing are listed on the slide here. So for example, feedback from workers indicating that an employee is behaving erratically. If you have an employee who's worked for you with no problem for 10 years and all of a sudden people are going up and saying, oh my goodness, Joe is acting so strange, he's doing X, Y, and Z, I've never seen him do that before, that's probably a good indicator that there's something else going on. Or that there's a sudden drop in attendance and increased use of sick leave, an increased number of lateness, sudden changes in behavior, unusually poor work performance, or starting to smell of alcohol on a regular basis. Fortunately, those are all areas where now you as an employer should be seeking further information to know whether or not the accommodation process is triggered. And in the event that you do not look into that, there's something that we're going to go through in a couple of case laws in a on the next few slides, where there's something called constructive knowledge, where basically the tribunal is going to say, you employer, you've known this employee for 10 years, they start acting very strange, they start taking a lot of time off, and you just simply decide to terminate as opposed to investigating. And then after you terminate them, they say, hey, I've been really struggling with mental illness. I have been dealing with it on my own. I didn't think I need to raise it with you, and I didn't tell you this. The tribunal is going to say, well, you employer should have looked into it. You had all those signs, and you just chose to close your eyes, ignore it, and terminate. And that's not going to meet the duty to accommodate. So unfortunately, there is that constructive knowledge concept that means that in these instances, you should be digging a little bit further, which is why we frequently tell clients when dealing with employees with strange behavior to have a sit-down conversation and say, hey, is there anything here we need to know that's going on? And opening up that door, documenting that conversation, and hearing what they have to say. Perhaps even in that case, providing or advising employees of certain services available underneath your employee benefits plan, such as the employee assistance program. Now, in the event you have that sit-down conversation, you're seeking that further information, you've offered accommodation options, and the response back from the employee is, no, I'm fine, I don't need anything, I'm good, thanks for asking. Well, then, no further actions required. It's not like you have to then force an accommodation on somebody in that case, but make sure you document that you had that conversation, what the response was, save it to file just in case in the event that, let's say, a termination does occur in the future and then they try to raise it, you can at least then say, hey, we asked. We provided you with options. You turned them all down. And then at least you can demonstrate that you attempted to engage in the accommodation process.
So we're going to go through a couple of cases now where the employer may have faltered under step one, so recognizing the need for accommodation. And as you're going to see, we have provided a lot of background facts, and the reason being, as Aaron said off the top, there is no one-size-fits-all approach to accommodation, and all the facts in play are important. And so we want to see here where the employer may have gone wrong to make sure that we are kind of taking a lesson learned from their mistake. So in this case, it's a Machado case. The employee was hired as a business manager. The employee at the time of hiring had chronic ulcerative colitis, a condition which can go obviously into remission and subsequently flare up. Unfortunately, the employee did not at the time of being hired or shortly thereafter advise the company of her medical condition. Then the employee ended up having a high record of absenteeism and tardiness over the subsequent four-month period, but she never advised, again, the employer of her medical condition. So she just missed a bunch of time, and there was no information given to the employer. So the company decided, much like Aaron suggested, that maybe we'll call her into a meeting to advise her. Actually, no, sorry, they didn't do what we suggested. They called her in a meeting and advised that she was being removed from her position because she was unreliable. She wasn't showing up for work. She wasn't arriving on time. She was offered a different position and was asked to respond to the company's offer within 2 business days. They gave her very little time to consider it, and they didn't ask her if something was going on. They decided to remove her based upon her potentially non-culpable behavior. During the meeting, the employee then advised the company that she did have a disability, and she provided some doctor's notes. when the employee did not respond to the company's offer regarding her decision, they promptly terminated her employment. As you can appreciate, the employee then brought a claim before the Human Rights Tribunal of Ontario, arguing that she had been discriminated based upon a disability and that there was a failure to accommodate. The company's position was that the duty to accommodate was not triggered because the employee never asked for an accommodation in the meeting. Now we can see where this is going to go based upon Aaron's allusion to the idea of constructive knowledge. Here, the tribunal found that the fact that the employee did not phrase her disclosure as a request for accommodation was not sufficient enough for the company to avoid its duty to accommodate. The duty to accommodate arose by the employee's disclosure of her disability as the reason for her tardiness. So she's essentially saying, my behavior is non-culpable because I have a disability. At which point, the company should have commenced an appropriate assessment of whether or not it could accommodate her medical circumstances. So they failed in the duty to accommodate by not even asking the employee if she needed accommodation when faced with information as related to her medical situation. And even worse, she made a link between the two, and the employer just simply ignored that information because she didn't use the words, I request accommodation. In this case, she was awarded $7,500 essentially in lost income and $7,500 in general damages. I note, importantly, this case is from 2011, those numbers in terms of general damages would likely have gone much higher now. Our tribunals are awarding larger general damages claims year over year. I would estimate probably that she would have been awarded something in the range of a minimum of $20,000 to $25,000 as opposed to $7,500 as was awarded in this case.
So a next example of an employer faltering at step one is the next case, Gainsler and Method Integration. The employee had a history of performance issues, and after the receipt of a poor performance review, the employee met with his manager and disclosed that he had recently been officially diagnosed with ADHD, and he was of the view that his ADHD was at the heart of his performance issue. The employee, though, did not make any specific request for accommodation during the meeting, so he did not specifically say, I think I need X, Y, and Z in order to meet your performance expectations. So instead, the manager said, great, thanks for letting me know. Apparently, actually, and it's not noted on the slide, the manager just did a general Google search about ADHD just to read up on it. He thought that that was sufficient for looking into things. And the employee never offered his manager to provide information with regards to ADHD. The manager did not inquire as to whether or not he needed any accommodations regarding his ADHD. So obviously, his performance issues continued. And eventually his employment was terminated. So once again, employee brings a claim before the Human Rights Tribunal of Ontario. And once again, the company argued that the duty to accommodate was not triggered because the employee never asked for an accommodation. He just advised us that he has a medical condition. So what? And so of course, the tribunal held that once the employee advised his manager that he suffered from ADHD and believed it was at the heart of his performance issues, the duty to accommodate had been triggered. And the company had an obligation to assess the nature of the employee's disability-related needs and whether or not it could accommodate them prior to the termination of his employment, which was clearly related to performance issues, which he related to his ADHD. So he was awarded $10,000 in general damages, which again, as Alex noted, this case is a little bit more recent from 2014. So most likely we're seeing again higher increase in awards, and that's a possibility here. And the company was actually required to retain an outside human rights expert within 3 months of the date of the decision to assist in the development and implementation of a comprehensive human rights policy and training program. And that program had to be in place within 6 months of the date of the decision. So just an example there of how it's not just necessarily about monetary awards to the employee, but additional obligations could be placed on the company as well.
Once we recognize that there is a need for accommodation, we jump to step two, which is the gathering of supporting documentation and assess the needs of the employee. So as an employer, you are legally entitled to receive sufficient information to provide or at least assess accommodation options. And so when an employee refuses to participate, then our duty to accommodate, our obligation to accommodate likely ceases at that point. But if the employee is participating, then we are kind of going in the right direction. So we're going to want to document all steps. And usually what that means is we are requesting information in writing. As many of you work with us on our med files, we do prepare the letters and medical certificates that go out to the employee and their doctor. This stuff is very important. It allows us, if the employee down the road alleges that we failed to accommodate, we can hold this paperwork up and say, we know we were participating in the accommodation process. Here are all the documents that were involved in our request for information. And if the employee doesn't obviously cooperate, then that is going to go a different way for the employee. Now, we're also going to want to consult various organizational resources, such as the employee handbook or the collective agreement. We may also want to consult with the employee and the union, if applicable, when we're gathering information. Also, what we're trying to do is kind of seek some clarity from the employee as to what type of accommodation is needed and ask for the documents that support that. So, for example, with a disability, we're going to want the employee's treating physician to complete a functional ability form. Without that information, how are we supposed to know what type of accommodation we need to look at? Now, we have often said that we are not entitled to a diagnosis or treatment information, so we should not be requesting that information. What we are entitled to is information relating to an employee's expected return to work date, any details regarding any accommodations or restrictions that are required upon the employee's return, and the length of the accommodations that they know. Like the time those conditions need to be in place. So once we have that information, we are in a better position to assess what, if any, accommodation we can provide as relates to disability. As relates to religious holidays and observances, we're going to want to gather information regarding the holidays and consult with any policies in terms of any time off. Any time off. I'm associated with those holidays. So, I guess, and the last example would be under family status. Again, we did an e-learning that kind of did a real deep dive on this area, but this is a developing and conflicting area. It seems to be that the pattern has been that as time progresses, the prohibited ground of family status is ever expanding. So we need to be mindful of this, and it's going to continue to be an issue as things go forward. So we need to understand, in this particular instance, what is the employee's child care or elder care need. So it's not simply about the obligations that you have for your children or your employees have for their children. It also relates to any elder care responsibilities they have. So we want to understand what those are. Then we're going to want to discuss with the employee whether they can make alternative arrangements, whether they have been explored. Now, there are some decisions, primarily in Ontario, that says an employee does not have to self-accommodate first before the duty to accommodate arises. That does not prevent us from asking the employee or suggesting to the employee what have they done to remedy the situation themselves before we make any changes. We're going to also want to provide programs through EAP or otherwise to assist the employee with his or her search for services. So, for example, if they aren't aware of any specific facilities for elder care, we're going to want to direct them to those facilities or those resources so they can try to self-accommodate so then we can minimize the impact it has on our workplace. We're going to also want to provide them with direct assistance as it relates to that. So if we are aware of a daycare facility that is near them, there's nothing wrong with a little nudge to indicate, well, I know there is this daycare in your area. Have you explored that? We're also going to want to explore whether other employees are prepared to cooperate to facilitate in the accommodation. Oftentimes, the request is, I want to leave early, or I need to arrive late, or I need to miss a certain day of the week. Well, we're going to want to know kind of right away whether or not other employees would be on board to help facilitate that accommodation. So that might be helpful in terms of us being able to do that or not. And then ultimately, as it relates to family status, more often than not, the accommodations are going to come down to scheduling. And so we want to consider whether there are some reasonable changes that we can make to enable the employee to continue to provide kind of work for us, but kind of within the parameters of their restrictions.
So now that we know that the duty's been triggered, we have a good understanding of what the employee is requesting, we have all the documentation as it relates to their request, step three is to make an informed decision. And the important thing that we like to stress to our clients is you must take the time to review the request, understand the needs, and review the documentation to then look to find the most effective, practical solution. So this is where the creativity kicks in. The idea here is that you should be exploring all possible options. When we say all possible options, we're going to be going through some case law later on in this presentation that really demonstrates that that's really what the tribunals are looking for. They're not just looking for, you know, it's inconvenient, it's going to cause, you know, some disruption in the workplace. That's too bad. That's not the undue hardship analysis, which we would get to. But certain things that you typically should be examining in this process is whether the employee can perform his or her existing job as is based upon the request, whether or not the employee can perform his or her job with modifications, such as the modifications we discussed earlier, like different hours, different workstations, us providing more breaks, and so on, whether or not the employee can perform another job within the workplace as is. That's one of the biggest things that tends to surprise clients. A lot of clients come to us and say, yep, you know what? This employee works in this role, and this role cannot be modified in any way, shape, or form to meet the requirements of the employee. I think we need to place them on a leave of absence. Our response is then going to be, well, hold on, before you do so, have you explored all other jobs in the organization? And when we say all other jobs in the organization, we truly do mean that. And that means undertaking analysis to see, A, if the employee is qualified to do a particular position, and B, if they are qualified to do that particular position, can it be modified? Can they do it as is, or can it be modified so that they can do it? And that could potentially be the actual modification. And then even if it's not a particular job that you have, are there potential job duties that could be bundled together to create a productive position? So here we're basically talking about, well, is there legitimate work that you need done that could be done that we could cobble together that gives them their hours of work and meets any sort of restrictions that they have? And if so, that's the possible reasonable accommodation. So as you can see, it's not simple. It really is doing an exercise of analyzing everything. And so the important thing to know is that you can take the time to do this. So I know sometimes clients feel pressured. You have the employee, let's say, who's trying to come back from a medical leave of absence. They're really interested in coming back. They're kind of pushing you on it. The bottom line is that this is an actual analysis that you have to undertake and spend time on. So don't feel bad if you have to go to the employee and say, listen, you know, we appreciate that you really want to come back, but we really do need to look at your request and look at what we have to determine the possible accommodations, and we'll get back to you as soon as possible. And don't feel bad if you have to say that.
So one of the primary considerations under step three in making an informed decision is the idea of undue hardship. And so there's no precise legal definition of undue hardship, nor is there a standard formula for determining undue hardship. Each situation is going to be unique and should be evaluated individually. Now, the case law has clearly said that the employer must show that its attempts to accommodate were serious, conscientious, genuine, and demonstrated its best efforts. Now, employers are required to carefully review all options, as Aaron kind of outlined earlier, before deciding that an accommodation would cause undue hardship. It's not enough to claim undue hardship based upon an assumption or an opinion. We must prove undue hardship with actual hard evidence. And so our Supreme Court has given us a non-exhaustive list of six factors that are relevant to what constitutes undue hardship, and we're going to go through them here. They are the financial costs. What's the cost of the requested accommodation? Are there safety concerns with the accommodation? How big is the employer's operation? That's going to impact things. The interchangeability of the workforce and the facilities. Are we able to move people around? Can everyone do the same job? Those types of things. Now, we're going to also want to look at the impact of the collective agreement and whether there or not there will be any problems amongst the employees if we implement our accommodation. And it's clear from subsequent case law that some of these factors have significantly more weight than others. Oftentimes, we hear from clients, undue hardship, it costs too much. Unfortunately, the financial consequences or the financial costs associated with undue hardship are rarely accepted as the legitimate basis to refuse the accommodation. So more often than not, when we say it's too expensive, that's not going to end the inquiry because generally costs will only amount to undue hardship if it can be established that they are A, related to the accommodation, they're provable in terms of we can actually say what the hard number is, not some kind of speculative number. And the number has to be so substantial that the cost would essentially change the essential nature of our operation or substantially impact the financial viability of the operation. So cost will only be a factor if we can essentially say we're going to go bankrupt if we agree to this accommodation. Lastly, an employer seeking to argue that proposed accommodation could not have been accomplished without substantial costs. Again, we must have detailed financial evidence. We can't say we think it's going to be this much or it might be this much. We need those hard numbers if we're going to put forward that as our argument for not being able to accommodate.
Now, unlike financial costs, safety is an actual factor that will be given significant weight by courts and tribunals. So this is one where if there is legitimate safety concerns, certainly courts and tribunals are more willing to hear the undue hardship argument raised. And so the issue here is to examine whether or not the proposed accommodation would pose a safety risk first to other employees or to the employee seeking the accommodation itself. And typically what we see in the case law is where the safety risks affect other employees, undue hardship is likely to be found. So, for example, you have somebody who, let's say, is in a workshop and requires a beard in order to meet his religious practices, and that beard prevents him from wearing an appropriate safety apparatus, which if he cannot put on in the event of an issue in the workplace, would actually affect the ability of other employees in that they could not assist other employees in the event of an emergency, then that may in fact be undue hardship to the point where we cannot have him in that position. However, where the safety risk only affects the employee requesting the accommodation and it's been canvassed with that employee, hey, listen, here are the safety risks. Hey, listen, here's what these risks may entail to you. And if the employee is okay with those risks, then the courts may actually say, well, you know what? That's actually just going to be something that we have to be okay with and you have to provide them the accommodation. So some relevant factors in that analysis is obviously the willingness of the person to assume certain risks, whether the modification or waiving of those requirements are likely to result in a serious health risk to the safety of others, as we just discussed, other types of risks legally tolerated in the workplace, and other types of risks we are okay as a society to undertake. And clearly, the Supreme Court of Canada has indicated that zero tolerance safety rules may fail in the duty to accommodate if they do not build in concepts of equality. So unfortunately, zero tolerance policies most likely aren't going to be policies that you can turn to us and say, look, we have the zero tolerance policy of this in the workplace. We absolutely cannot budge on this. Well, unfortunately, the duty to accommodate says, well, you actually have to conduct a further analysis than that. That's not going to be sufficient enough to meet the undue hardship analysis.
One of the other factors we look at, again, is the size of the operation or the interchangeability of our operation. So as it relates to the size of the operation, obviously the larger the operation is, the more likely it is that we can afford to permit a wider range of accommodations. So what may amount to a prohibitively expensive or disruptive accommodation for a small workplace may be found to be entirely affordable and reasonable for a large workplace. The second factor would be interchangeability. This factor relates to the flexibility of our operations and is often linked to the size of the operation. So our facility is large enough, adaptable enough to be able to implement the accommodations. This factor obviously is linked to the size of larger workplaces because those will be able to create more flexible accommodations for particular needs. On the other aspect of undue hardship arguments are provisions of the collective agreement. Now, there are circumstances where a viable accommodation can override the provisions of a collective agreement unless that proposed accommodation would significantly interfere with the rights of other employees. Before this duty does trump a collective agreement, we need to explore whether there are less intrusive accommodations that meet the restrictions or the needs without violating the collective agreement, and then we kind of go from there in terms of on the least amount of intrusion over the collective agreement. Now, more often than not, the largest issue is going to be as relates to seniority. And so arbitrators have generally recognized that relative seniority rates of other workers is of fundamental importance, and the impact on those rights frequently do amount to undue hardship. However, an employer cannot rely upon seniority provisions as an absolute bar to an accommodated return to work. So oftentimes you'll see something where there is an available position, but there are certain posting rules, and usually the successful candidate is based upon seniority. More often than not, if seniority plays a role in the accommodation or the infringement of another employee's seniority, that may stop that part of the duty to accommodate. So it's important also to involve the union in the accommodation process when there are these issues, because we want to avoid any grievances regarding both the duty to accommodate and how it might kind of violate the collective agreement. So we kind of want to be transparent here, say, hey, union, listen, this is what we are recommending for an accommodation. Are you going to grieve this on behalf of the other employees whose collective agreement rights are being violated? Because I've seen oftentimes where we come up with a great accommodation, but we haven't run it by the union, and the union then says, well, yes, you are meeting the duty to accommodate for employee X, but you're also violating the rules for employee Y, so we're going to bring a grievance on behalf of the other employees. So be mindful of that. And I think I'm passing it back to Aaron here. We have a couple cases. We're going to go through one case here, and then we are going to skip over a couple of cases because we are running short on time. So we do want to go through all of the steps with you, but please feel free to revisit all of these cases when you get a chance or give us a call to go through them.
So the reason why we selected this case is because it genuinely demonstrates how far reaching the duty to accommodate goes in terms of the number of steps you have to undertake. As we've been trying to really hit home here, this is an extensive process. And so it can't just be a one-and-done quick analysis, sorry, can't accommodate. So in this case, the employee worked as a communication technician and eventually required a medical leave of absence due to her depression. The employee presented the employer with a note indicating she could return to work on a gradual basis so long as she could work from home. The company, though, denied her request because she was not able to work independently without a high level of supervision and had not been fully trained in the position prior to her commencing the medical leave of absence. And the training for the job would require her to attend at the office for at least a period of 6 months, and that training could not be provided remotely. Eventually, the employee was able to return to work on a gradual basis, working 3 days a week from the office. So the company provided her with an 8-month temporary accommodation working on a specific project that would meet her weekly hours requirement. However, when the project was complete, the employee was advised that it would have to place her on a medical leave of absence until she could return to work full-time or another position became available that met her restrictions. So the company continued to search for whether or not it could, in fact, meet her three-day working requirements, and offered her part-time employment at a different location from the employee's normal working condition, location that met her needs. The employee refused the offer because the position was far from her home, and she raised the fact that she had a prior back condition to that prevented her from lengthy travel, and sleep problems prevented her from working the evenings, which could meet her part-time requirements. None of this medical documentation had been previously provided to the employer, so the employer had to go back to the table to look for, once again, part-time work that met her back conditions and her sleeping requirements. The employee the company then commenced the search for another position, and in terms of their search, they looked and they asked all business units about any vacancies, whether or not any duties could be bundled to create a position, could the duties be separated from other work to allow for a work-from-home arrangement. They followed up with the unit of business units on a weekly basis, and essentially, as much as the company searched and searched, they couldn't find a position which met the restrictions of the medical notes, and eventually the employee was approved for long-term disability benefits. So notwithstanding the fact that she was provided with long-term disability benefits, the employee brought a claim before the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, alleging that the company failed to accommodate her. And essentially alleging, hey, first and foremost, you should have allowed me to return to work when I could work from home. You should have let me work from home, and you shouldn't have placed me on a continued absence, and you failed to properly look for any other job that met my return to work requirements, and you should have let me continue to work that temporary accommodation job even though the project was done. Well, thank goodness the company was found to have met its duty to accommodate. On the point of the work-from-home arrangement, the tribunal agreed that it would have caused the company undue hardship to accommodate the employee by allowing her to train and work from home in that position, because the company was able to demonstrate with hard evidence that one-on-one training was required to meet the essential duties of the position and that the training could not be provided at home. And the tribunal further agreed that the company met its accommodations efforts because it was able to once again demonstrate through hard evidence that it continued to attempt to provide her with accommodated work, and no positions were available, but they were at least able to demonstrate that they were in fact reaching out to other business units, that they continued their search to those business units to see if they could meet the needs outlined in her medical note.
So in the materials, as I referenced, there is a case, it's McMillan and Coast Mountain Bus Company case. We are going to skip over that today. You can revisit that, but that case is a great example of how the duty to accommodate undue hardship and a collective agreement or multiple collective agreements actually comes into play. If you have any questions after you reviewed that finding, we'd be happy to go through that. So we're going to talk about, on slide 34, on the bona fide occupational requirement, which is another thing that we're going to be looking at under step three. And so the law does recognize that there is a limitation on individual rights that may be reasonable and justifiable in certain limited situations. Specifically, if an employer can show that there are specific job requirements that an individual performing a specific job must meet that are essential to the effective and safe performance of the job, then there is no duty to accommodate and does not constitute discrimination. It's known as bona fide occupational requirements, also known as bona fide occupational qualifications. There is some different terminology throughout the jurisdictions. These are not employer preferences. They are duties or elements that are essential to the job. So, for example, one example that's not a bona fide occupational requirement is a Korean restaurant who only hires people of Korean descent to ensure that every one of their patrons has a genuine Korean experience. This is not a BFOR. This is a preference and therefore a discriminatory hiring process. Alternatively, if we require airline pilots to meet certain vision standards in order to safely fly an aircraft, this is a bona fide occupational requirement because it's necessary to ensure the safe performance of the job. Therefore, it is not a discriminatory hiring practice. Again, the Supreme Court of Canada, in the case we referenced earlier, the Mioran case, outlines the three-step process to determine whether something is a preference, or a bona fide occupational requirement. So the first step is the rule or standard adopted by the employer rationally connected to the performance of the job? So a general review of the particular work being performed. The second question is, did the employer adopt a particular standard based upon an honest and good faith belief that is necessary to fulfill a work-related purpose? This is an assessment of your subjective intent for creating the standard. And then the last part of the analysis is the standard reasonably necessary in that it would be impossible to accommodate an individual without imposing undue hardship upon the employer. So that's the undue hardship analysis associated with that. If you fail as an employer at any one of these steps, then we have failed to establish a bona fide occupational requirement. And I'm looking at my clock here, and we have about 6 minutes to go. So I'm going to run through this case, and then we can go through step five with you guys here. So the case is on the Ontario Rights Commission and the Christian Horizon cases. And so the employer in this case was a faith-based charitable organization that provides residential homes and care to people with mental disabilities. Now, the employer required all of its employees to hold a lifestyle and morality statement that barred, amongst other things, homosexual relationships. They also employed a personal support worker. Now, 4 years into that person's employment, she commenced a same-sex relationship. She advised a couple of her staff members about that relationship, and eventually it got to the supervisor, and the supervisor confronted her about that. She was offered specific morality counseling to restore her to a state of compliance with a lifestyle and morality statement. She began, unfortunately, after that, a very toxic work environment after disclosing her relationship status, and eventually the employee went on a medical leave of absence and then ultimately resigned from her employment. She brought a claim to the Human Rights Tribunal, and based upon all that kind of transpired as it relates to her same-sex relationship, the employer tried to argue that requiring her to avoid same-sex relationships was a valid occupational requirement for a support worker. There was a number of different decisions, and it ultimately ended up in front of the divisional court, and what they held was that the employer was unable in this case to prove a direct and substantial relationship between the job's qualifications and the abilities and qualities needed to satisfactorily perform the particular job. So in this particular case, the job required the person to cook, clean, do laundry, help residents eat and wash, and take them to appointments. They were not hired nor expected to bring the residents into the Christian religion that they were advocating by having them adopt a certain lifestyle. The tasks that they performed were not intended to infuse the residents of the home with lifestyle morals of the organization. Essentially, their duties were not to kind of be an example for the residents as it relates to this is the lifestyle you need to lead in order to be welcomed by our church. There was no link between what they were doing and the restrictions being placed on this person's individual freedom to have a same-sex relationship. So in this case, there was a large damage award. As you can see, it was $23,000, and they were also awarded some money for lost wages that wasn't specified in the decision. So as you can see, there needs to be a link between what you are adopting as your BFOR and essentially what the job is. And if there is no link there, then we're not going to be able to rely upon the BFOR as our defense for the failure to accommodate.
So now we've reviewed all the information. We've determined what the appropriate accommodation is. Now, of course, the next step is to advise the individual of the accommodation and implement the decision. And just a quick note, employers with 50 or more employees in Ontario are required to have documented individual accommodation plans in accordance with the AODA. So if you need assistance with that, obviously please feel free to reach out to us. And particularly of note, if you are denying a request for accommodation, the reasons for the decision should be clearly communicated to the employee in writing. that, again, is absolutely vital. Particularly, we find with disability cases, we need to basically be advising them, hey, here's all the searches that we did based upon the notes that you provided to us. And then in that case, typically the appropriate accommodation isn't necessarily termination, but instead a continued medical leave of absence for the employee until that position becomes available that meets the restrictions in the note, or alternatively, the employee's restrictions change themselves. And then obviously the last step is to follow up and keep records. So we should be regularly following up with employees and modifying any accommodations as necessary. We do, though, however, want to say be cautious about asking employees too frequently for affidavit medical documentation, because there certainly is case law out there that indicates that frequently requesting medical information could actually be harassment. And then, of course, as we've stressed throughout everything here, document, document, document. So make sure you maintain all documents regarding that your accommodation efforts, including all communications to the employee, because that is what we're going to be asking you for in the event that you do in fact receive a claim with regards to discrimination, because that's the documentation that's going to build your defense. We don't like witness testimony here. We want to be able to actually show to the courts and tribunals that you have in fact undertaken that thorough analysis. And that documentation is going to be key there.
So in sum, the first thing, we just want to be aware of what the prohibited grounds of discrimination are in your jurisdiction, because without a prohibited ground of discrimination, there won't be a duty to accommodate. So we need to understand how those apply where your workers work. And we also need to know when the duty to accommodate is triggered. We've gone through some of that stuff. There is that idea of constructive knowledge, asking the right questions, we can't turn a blind eye, that sort of stuff. And as Aaron has alluded to earlier, we need to undertake an individual analysis. There is not a one-size-fits-all approach. So accommodations should be made on a case-by-case basis, and unfortunately, there is no set formula. Document, 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 that applies to everything that we do. On that, quickly, we want to make sure that we're not documenting things that are going to hurt us. So we don't want to put things in email saying, oh, God, Aaron's requesting this accommodation anymore. She's so annoying. That stuff should not be documented. What we're trying to document is anything that we want to put in front of a tribunal if it ever gets there. That's the stuff we want documented, all of our efforts to accommodate, not any negative extra commentary related to an employee and their requests. And as always, please consult with us. That includes, after having reviewed that on those couple of cases that we skipped over, if you have any questions about that or any questions related to these steps, please don't hesitate to contact us. We're more than happy to discuss this as it applies to your individual circumstances. And lastly, and most importantly, enjoy your summers. If we don't speak with you, have a lovely time, and we will be back in September for our next e-learning of 2018. And until then, on behalf of Aaron and everyone else here, we wish to thank you for joining us today, and again, enjoy your summer. Thanks, everyone.